And then the reason we put out the second book was that we felt that we needed to have a new book with newer literature in it, with more modern authors represented. And also we wanted to expand it to include the Flemish literature and the literature from Indonesia and the ABC Islands in the Caribbean. And so the first book was then allowed to go out of print, and the second book then took its place. But by that time, we were beginning to develop a lot of competition. There were a lot of competing books out there, and so that book has now, I guess, gone out of print. It lasted about 10 years.
Is there another Dutch reader from you apt to appear?
I don't think so, because as you know, the next thing I did was to get involved with Japanese.
Tell us about that.
Well, in 1961, I went to a meeting in Japan it was the 25th anniversary meeting of the Japan Society of Chemical Engineers. And then the following year, I was invited to spend a whole year, that was 62-63, in Japan as a visiting Fulbright professor. So I spent a half a year at Kyoto University and a half year at Nagoya University. And I took private Japanese lessons when I was there and worked very hard at the language. But by the end of the year, I wasn't able to read technical things, and I wasn't able to have technical discussions with my colleagues. And I felt terribly depressed and terribly upset and disconcerted and disappointed.
Could you by that time handle non-technical conversation, grocery store shopping, that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, to a limited extent. I mean, I could get around because I had learned the grammar pretty well by then, and I had a reasonable daily life vocabulary, so I was able to get along. But I felt so bad that I couldn't function in connection with the technical language. So when I came back to Madison, I started making systematic studies of the kanji. Those are the Chinese characters that are used in Japanese. I started making an intensive study of these to find out what the distribution was of these characters in the technical language. So I took a physics book, a high-level high school physics book, and I went through and I counted the number of times each character appeared in this book. And so I could build up a frequency diagram and know which characters were the most frequent and which ones were the least frequent. And what I found, my amazement, was if you knew 300 out of the total of about 3,000 of these characters, if you knew the right 300, you could read 90% of a physics text. And so later on, I joined together with Ed Daub and a Japanese professor in Tokyo, and the three of us put out a book called Comprehending Technical Japanese. And this was a technical reader, the idea was you could use this technical reader and learn what these 300 important characters are, and then get trained in the art of reading technical Japanese. So this was intended as a second or third year book for students of Japanese who want to go into the direction of reading technical material. And Ed Daub was the senior author of that book, and because he had spent something like 10 or 11 years in Japan. And then after that book came out, he became the director of the Technical Japanese Program here at Wisconsin. So we actually founded a new field here, and he became the director of that. This was the only university to start up a program of that type. And then later on in 1990, we put out a second book called Basic Technical Japanese, which is a grammar book designed specifically for people who want to go into reading technical Japanese and who don't want to know anything about conversation at all. They just want to aim towards a very narrow goal. And both of those books have done quite well. I think the first one's in its fifth printing, and the basic technical Japanese, I believe, is either in the second or third printing. And since our pioneering effort here, why other schools have started up technical Japanese courses.
Is your textbook used in those other institutions?
I believe it is. I don't have any of the sales figures on this. I do know that we now have, well, Ed Daub is now retired, and his successor is Jim Davis. And Jim Davis now gives the course by television. And he has been training people at the Chemical Abstract Service in Columbus by means of a TV hookup, as well as people in a number of industries who also want to learn how to be competent in technical Japanese translation.
So as a very new faculty member here, you had significant input into changing the curriculum in chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. And as a result of your own travels to Netherlands, mm-hmm. you had an influence on getting a Dutch program established in the German department mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. And as a result of your stay in Japan, you had an influence in getting a Japanese program established at the university.
Mm-hmm.
What other departments have you started up at the university?
I think that's all. Isn't that enough?
That's enough. That's more than usual, certainly.
Well,
but it is interesting that your own keen interests as they develop, extending your own competences outside of chemical engineering, are registered in what happens in the university. You have found it a very receptive place for your own interest outside of your specialty.
Yes. I should add here, too, that in these language hobby interests, I have the full support of the administration on this. When I started to work on the Dutch project, the first one, I went to the head of the chem engineering department, who was Professor Raggetts at that time, and asked him if he had any objection to my spending part of my time on this. And he said, absolutely not. He said, as long as you do your work in chemical engineering, why, it's perfectly fine if you want to do that. Then when I started up the work on technical Japanese, Bob Marshall heard about this, and he said, look, if you produce anything you'd like to have published, we'll turn it out as a report from the engineering experiment station. He says, I encourage you to work on this. He says, I think that's an important thing to do. And then later on, when I got a campus-wide professorship, I wanted to spend part of my time then doing either Dutch or Japanese, and I had to check that out with the chancellor. I went up to see the chancellor and asked him if there was any problem if I diverted some of my funds to this hobby. And, oh, he was very enthusiastic about that. So at every step, I've had an enthusiastic support by administrative officials. And I know there are some universities where that sort of thing would not be tolerated.
Well, I've been waiting, but I haven't heard you say you've had a similar impact on the music program at the university.
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
But you did mention that you are doing some composing now.
Well, that's just a hobby.
That's it.
These are little musical exercises. I just have to do something.
But they haven't been publicly performed?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. I sometimes play them at our department Christmas parties, where I have a captive audience.
Yes.
I think maybe they would rather I didn't perform.
Well, I doubt that, but it sounds as though your fingers are not so stiff that you won't undertake such performances yourself.
Well, I can assure you that this is pretty rudimentary music, and my performances are not what you'd call stellar.
Well, you've had very strong encouragement at the university and have had an illustrious career here. And I believe it's been recognized by awards and memberships and other kinds of organizations. Tell us about those.
Must I?
Well, it would help the record be complete at this time. Don't be modest. This is recording for people to get the complete picture of what a university professor really is.
Well, in the first place, I think you know as well as I do that receiving awards and recognition is a matter of luck to a very large extent. And
you have to have friends that will nominate you.
Yes, you do. And you have to have colleagues who are supportive in those efforts. And but luck plays a lot. I mean, I've served on a number of awards panels myself, and gosh, you know, you have one slot you're trying to fill for an award or a membership in an academy or something like that, and for every one of these awards that you can make, there are 10 or 12 others that could just as well have been the recipients of these awards. So I tend myself not to put too much emphasis on those things.
But just for the record, which one do you take most pleasure, private pleasure, in remembering?
Well, I don't know that I take private pleasure in these things. I'm happy for the department and the university that we get recognition that way. I mean, you don't, when you get these awards, there's nothing you can do with them. They don't make you feel any better. You can't buy anything with it.
But it is nice to have peers acknowledge you've achieved.
It's nice to know that something that you've done, often with colleagues and co-authors, it's nice to know that work has been favorably received. I think the two of the honors that I've had that have meant a great deal to me for personal reasons were receiving an honorary doctorate from Delft in the Netherlands, because I had a lot of friends there. I had some very good friendships, very solid friendships, and my knowledge of the country and the institution itself, it was sort of like a homecoming party, and sort of like it just gave me a very comfortable feeling, a very warm feeling to have that kind of recognition. And then the other one was the honorary doctorate from Kyoto University several years ago, because here again I had taught there, and we've had people from Kyoto University spending time here, and I've maintained my connections with those people, and here again I have some very, very wonderful, I formed some very wonderful friendships with those people. And so going back to Kyoto and in that sort of a, for that sort of a ceremony was very heartwarming, very nostalgic.
Were the honorary degrees at both of those institutions awarded in such a way that all of the speaking associated with it was in the native language pertaining to each university, or did they spill over into English?
No, the one in Holland was completely in Dutch, and I think the one in Japan was completely in Japanese.
Mm-hmm. But you could understand completely both of them.
The one in Dutch, yes. The one in Japanese, the language was so flowery and so complex, and that I'm sure I missed a great deal of that.
They were using different figures for the flowers.
Yes, but I mean my knowledge of Japanese is rather limited to the technical part of the subject. So I don't have a very big vocabulary for formal spoken Japanese.
Well, I believe you received an award from the Rheology Society, didn't you?
Yes.
That was for your research achievements, or was it primarily for your textbook, or just general leadership in the field?
I believe that was before the textbook came out, so that must have been for the my early research work.
And you were elected to the National Academy of Engineering, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And do you recall what year that was?
Must have been 1969. It was the fifth year that they elected people to that academy.
Mm-hmm. And subsequently, you were elected to the National Academy of Sciences.
Yes.
It's rather unusual, isn't it, for a person to be in both of those academies?
Oh, well, Ed Lightfoot is a member of both of those academies, and there are about, seems to me there must be about 80 or 100 people who belong to both of them.
Both of these have, at least as part of their mission, advising the United States government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Scientific and engineering matters.
Mm-hmm.
Have you participated in that way in the academies?
No, I don't think I have been asked to do that.
Yeah.
And I haven't particularly pushed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I am more of a scholarly hermit than I am a committee person.
Any other honors, awards that you wish to mention?
Well, I'm an honorary member of the both the Dutch and Belgian Academies of Science. Here again, that means a great deal to me because of my association with the Netherlands, and less so with Belgium. But here again, that was very wonderful to have this chance to see old friends again, and to maintain the connections and the friendships.
Is your father still alive?
No, he's, after all, I'm nearly 75.
Yes.
It would be rather unusual.
Well, yes, but it would be possible.
No, he passed away in 1971.
So he was alive long enough to see the fruition of his firm direction of your career choice.
I suppose so, yes.
I'm sure he was proud that you had done so well.
Yes, I think he was. I think he. I think I turned out better than he expected.
Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have one brother. Yes.
What area did he get directed
into?
Well,
he worked for the Ling Temco Vought Aircraft Corporation in Dallas, and he retired in 1987, I guess it was. He's younger than I am, but he retired before I did.
Mm-hmm. During your career, you have been a member, I believe, of AICHE, mm-hmm. and have been elected a fellow of that organization.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in particular you would like to record about your association with the AICHE, your participation in the organization or its meetings?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not much of a committee person or a meeting person, but I go to AICHE meetings probably once every 2 or 3 years, and I've served on a couple of committees. One of them was called the Dynamics Objectives of Chemical Engineering. That was a committee back in the 1960s, I believe, that was put together to try to determine what the future directions of the field might be. And that was a fairly interesting committee to be on, mainly because of the people that I had a chance to meet there and interact with.
I would imagine also it would be a subject in which you took a great deal of interest, since you...
Oh, yes, I I guess I enjoyed going to those committee meetings, mainly because of the people and how much influence our final report had. I really don't know. I guess I think more gets done when a few individuals sit down and do it rather than having a committee sit and deliberate.
Have you held any office in AICHE, no. Local or national?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I can remember.
I'm sure you would remember. But you have been asked, you told me last night, to present a paper on history at an AICHE meeting this fall.
That's correct.
Do you have any particular feelings about the change in chemical engineering during your career, or as you look back over even before you started in the field? What's the principal shifts you find in the field?
Well, I think the field has undergone an enormous change. When I was an undergraduate, the emphasis was on unit operations, and particularly the unit operations of the petroleum industry. And Haugen and Watson's books were very strongly influenced by K.M. Watson's work in the petroleum industry. That was the industry in which the science was being most extensively exploited, and it was a big enough industry that they could afford the research and the exploitation of science, of the basic science. And of course, the nowadays, which is by that I mean 60 years later, the chemical engineers now are going into a much broader range of industries. Petroleum has ceased to be the main field in which our graduates are being hired. We have people now going into surfactants and detergents. We have many going into microelectronics. We have others going into the biotech area, which of course is really blossoming, as you know, at the present time. And we have others going into polymers and plastics. That's been another big area. So there's been this tremendous shift in the subject material, and the companies into which our students are moving now. The second thing that's had an enormous impact has been the development of the computer. The computer, of course, has made possible the implementation of a lot of theory, which before 1950, say, was just theory. You couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't calculate. It was too complicated. But nowadays, as you know, our beginning graduate students can make fantastic calculations and simulations and graphic displays that are mind-boggling to those of us who grew up in the 1940s and 50s.
Yeah.
Back when we took mechanical drawing and descriptive geometry
and punch cards with knitting needles was considered a very significant advance in literature collecting.
Yeah, that was back in the late 40s and early 50s that we were doing punch cards. And, my own thesis back in 1950 was done with punch cards and a whole bunch of IBM business machines, you know, regular accounting machines. My whole thesis nowadays could be done in an afternoon. Terrible to think how I wasted my time, isn't it?
Are you having any difficulty, or are your students having any difficulty finding employment these days? Or?
Well, keep in mind that I retired over 6 years ago, so I haven't really been following the employment picture recently. I have not heard from my colleagues of any crisis in this area, mm-hmm. so I presume that they're being successful.
You mentioned your retirement, but we are holding this interview in your office in the Chemical Engineering Building at the University of Wisconsin. What is your continuing relationship with the department after retirement?
Well, I suppose officially it's up to them, but I come to the office every morning, usually between 6:30 and 7.
You must be one of the earliest arrivals.
The chairman is often here by that time. As you know, chairmen have to get in early and stay late to get their jobs done. But usually I am one of the first people here. The first 2 years after I retired, I swore I was not going to do any more teaching and that I was going to really enjoy being retired. Then in 1994, 2 years after I retired, I accepted a visiting professorship in Delft again. And I went back over there and taught a course in kinetic theory of polymers. And then while I was there, I was invited to come to Belgium and lecture there in the fall on transport phenomena at the University of Louvain-la-Neuve. And so I did that. And about that time, I think people were beginning to wonder why I didn't just stay home and teach. And so while I was in Belgium, I had an urgent message from the chairman saying that they were shorthanded for the next semester, and when I got back to Madison, would I be willing to teach again? So I did that. And then they asked in the fall, would I be willing to do it again? And so I've been teaching ever since, although not always both semesters.
Cute. Teach what would be considered a full load, or you teach one course?
I just teach one course, mm-hmm. yes. And of course, I have no committee work. I don't go to department meetings. I don't have to fill out forms. I don't have to write grant proposals. So it's an idyllic life.
Well, I hope that it's arranged in Wisconsin so that you can lead this idyllic life, but not totally as a volunteer, that in spite of retirement that they are able to pay you for your part-time teaching. But so you do teach every semester now?
Or? I've had a few semesters off since I resumed my teaching duties.
Yes.
And I really enjoy it. I mean, it's such a wonderful group of students, and the last couple of years I've been teaching the graduate course in transport phenomena, and so that's material that I'm very familiar with.
Do you use your textbook?
Oh, yes. And as a matter of fact, we're rewriting the book.
Right? Oh, you are revising.
Yes, we're revising. The book is still in its first edition.
Yes.
And we're now preparing to put out a second edition, so I've...
All three authors are involved.
All three authors are involved. And we're hoping that we can finish this over a 2-year period. So between the textbook writing and the teaching, plus the fact that I'm doing some research with Chuck Curtis over in the chemistry department, that keeps me pretty busy.
It sounds as though it's hardly what most people consider retirement. About the only thing you retired from is making out exams.
Well, that's true. It's been as I say, it's an idyllic life. I'm doing all the things that I really enjoy with colleagues whom I really enjoy.
That's
and
wonderful.
With students that I really enjoy.
Good.
What could be nicer?
That's right. And in a lovely environment.
In a beautiful environment.
Yes.
That's right.
Well, do you think of